Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Our guest today on the Soapbox is a true American giant in history, Daniel Ellsberg. Daniel's bravery and integrity led to the end of the U.S. crime in Vietnam. Daniel is also the subject of an Academy Award-nominated documentary, A Dangerous Man. Dan, my friend, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Good to be here, Cindy.
Well, it's great to finally have you on. It's been a very busy year for you. We talked a little bit in the introduction about the documentary of what you did, A Dangerous Man, and it was nominated for an Academy Award, and I haven't seen it yet, unfortunately. I don't know why I haven't seen it yet, but tell my listeners about that experience and about, did you actually go to the Academy Awards?
We were there. We were nominated, but didn't win. Cindy, you'll enjoy it. It's at the Shattuck Theater still right now. It's held over in Berkeley.
The Shattuck? Okay. Well, how long is it going to be held over for?
Depends on how many of your listeners come and fill the theater.
The Shattuck Theater in Berkeley. And so my listeners should go. And
you should go. That's what I'm saying.
The opportunity to see it. But tell us about the movie. You were actually one of my heroes before my son was killed, before I was able to meet you and really, you know, find out in person what a wonderful man you are. But tell my listeners about why you are a dangerous man.
I was dangerous to Henry Kissinger. He was the one who used that phrase in 1971 because he and Nixon believed that I had documents on the Nixon administration, which went beyond the Pentagon Papers, which I had released at that time. Those papers had ended on U.S. decision-making in Vietnam. They actually ended in 1968, before Nixon came in. So although he hated the precedent of anyone having the temerity to tell the truth about our past decision-making on his own, he was glad to have that particular history out because it made the Democrats look bad. Indeed, it did. It showed a lot of lying by Kennedy and by Johnson and, indeed, getting us into the war. So as Kissinger put it, it really helps us a little bit, actually. You know, it's good for us. They agreed to that, but when they learned that I had some documents on their administration from their NSC, National Security Council, they had a lot to worry about because Nixon had been making nuclear threats to North Vietnam since 1969, very secretly from the American public, obviously not secretly to our adversaries to whom he was making the threats, and likewise threats of other escalation, mining of Haiphong, invasions of Laos and Cambodia, and possibly invasion of North Vietnam. So by the time of 1971, the Laos and Cambodia had actually been carried out, but the other threats had not yet been carried out, and he knew the public wouldn't really care for it to know that he'd been making those threats at all. So he was very worried that I would bring out documents on his administration, and that's what made me dangerous. And he had to shut me up if possible, and the way they first started to do that was by sending only a few Cuban-Americans who were CIA assets from the Bay of Pigs into the office of my former psychoanalyst in Los Angeles, looking for information with which they could blackmail me into silence. Information not that they would release immediately, but they would threaten me with releasing if I didn't shut up. And they didn't find what they wanted. It wasn't there. And there wasn't any such information. And it would have been hard to shut me up, in short. But then they set out to do it physically later when they were just about to mine Haiphong. They wanted me in particular to be quiet that week, and they brought a dozen Cubans up from Miami to incapacitate me totally. And they backed off of that when they feared they were going to be set up for arrest at that point, but they reconnoitered their next job, which was the Watergate. And when they were caught in the Watergate a few weeks later, they had the possibility of spilling to the prosecutors all the crimes they'd done against me at the orders of Nixon. So he had to shut them up by bribing them, gave Howard Hunt $140,000, and others paid lawyers' fees and other amounts. So G. Gordon Liddy didn't have to be paid money to keep his mouth quiet. quiet. He wanted to be a martyr for Der Führer, as he thought of it. He was a Nazi at heart, actually. I don't know if he still is, but at that time he was. But as somebody in the White House put it, Gordon's a Nazi, but he's our Nazi. And however, that served them well when it came to not having to pay him off for the crimes he'd committed. But the other people did have to be paid off, and that was a new crime of obstruction of justice. So when this web of lies and crimes and secrets threatened to come down, when John Dean began to spill the beans on it by revealing the raid into my doctor's office, Nixon was now realized that he was faced with impeachment, and spent the next year fighting that unsuccessfully in the end. When he was about to be impeached for these crimes, actually mainly against me, he resigned. And since he would have almost certainly continued the war in the air by resuming the bombing, and wasn't able to do that because he was fighting impeachment, his resignation really shortened the war by several years.
Right.
So, in short, it turned out I had been dangerous to him, but in particular, his fears of me did him in. That was the greatest danger.
Well, Daniel, I just did a show on the criminalization in this country of dissent. It's gotten far worse under the Obama administration. I and five colleagues just spent 50 hours in jail for protesting in front of the White House on March 20th. But you and what
that? Yes, congratulations. It isn't too hard to get arrested protesting in Washington these days. But congratulations for doing what you had to do.
But you know, and we were doing what we had to do. But what was frustrating to us is that when the barriers came down, hundreds of people didn't follow us. And you know, it's not comfortable being arrested. It's not fun. But you did this, and you were actually facing life in prison for your courageous act of getting the Pentagon Papers out. And is it frustrating to you that there's not somebody these days that would be willing or that has taken that step?
Yes, it's frankly, truthfully puzzling to me. I don't understand it. It's quite understandable that there wouldn't be a rush of people to face, let's say, 115 years in prison, which is what they charged me with, possibility. People have, you know, families and careers and various concerns that would keep them from doing that. But what is puzzling to me is that really no one has done it. It's obvious, as I just explained to you, that what I did not only changed public opinion quite a bit, which did not shorten the war, unfortunately, since Nixon was not paying any attention to public opinion, but it did provoke them into criminal acts, which, in fact, he was likely to get away with, but he didn't. And the effect was that it did shorten the war. So given that, it would seem to me that of the thousands and thousands of people in the administration who must realize that the decision to escalate in Afghanistan is disastrous and inexcusable, and holds no hope of any benefit for Americans or Afghans, on the contrary. Of the thousands who must realize that, I don't understand why not one really has come out and done everything they could in the way of releasing documents that would demonstrate that. Now, actually, at least one person, Matthew Hoh, H-O-H, was a Foreign Service officer, former Marine infantry officer like myself, but he'd been a company commander in combat. I was in peacetime. And he had then switched to a civilian job in the Foreign Service in Iraq, and I'm sorry, in Afghanistan,
uh-huh.
And was the senior civilian officer in a contested province in Afghanistan, and resigned from that. Having been offered jobs by the ambassador, Carol Eikenberry, and by Richard Holbrooke, our ambassador at large for the area,
right,
to keep him quiet, basically. And instead, he did resign and speak out, saying that, as in Vietnam, our project there in Afghanistan was hopeless and murderous, that we would only create more recruits for the Taliban by killing civilians and by putting more foreign troops in, since the main recruiting motivation for the Taliban is to expel foreigners from their country, namely us. So he did do what he could do. I don't think he probably had a lot of documents in his little province in Afghanistan. But there must be many people in the White House, in CIA, in the Pentagon, who do have a drawer and or a safe full of documents, as I did, that would demonstrate that they understood exactly what Matthew Ho did and could prove that to Congress. And they should be considering putting that out at whatever cost to their career. And I think if some of them considered it, I'm sure some of them would do it. So I have to infer that they haven't yet got around to considering it.
Well, I just don't. I think that we live in a different world, obviously, especially after 9/11, where any kind of dissent has been, horribly suppressed or marginalized. And we've had people resign. Our own dear friend Anne Wright resigned from the Foreign Service when our country invaded Iraq. But, you know, we need people that to get.
But you and I know we have friends like Anne Wright who did resign. And I asked Anne why she didn't bring out a lot of documents, and she said, Dan, she was the chargé d'affaires, the chief person in Mongolia, and she said, we weren't getting a lot of interesting cables in Mongolia. That was her apology. But, of course, as you know, she's worked tenaciously ever since right alongside you and getting arrested and testifying in Congress to keep us out. But there aren't, to get us out, but why there aren't more like that, I honestly don't understand.
Well, we just have to keep hoping that there will be something that comes out and does what you did. And they have to know that they'll be supported if something like that happens.
Well, you know that you yourself, from the outside, without any documents to give, just uttering the common sense, straightforward question, why are we in Iraq? What was the cause which led to my sons being killed there? What was the justification, if any? Just asking that question was the little boy pointing to the emperor's lack of clothes, and had a very big effect. So someone from the inside who could back up those same questions with the same willingness you did to put yourself out in front on that and risk being condemned and accused of lots of things, being called names, in a word. Just the fear of being called names is what I think is keeping Obama, as president, from getting us out of Afghanistan. He's afraid that McChrystal and Petraeus, his generals there, might resign. They might resign. The funny thing is that there's more fear of the right-wingers or the warmongers resigning and pressing their cause than there is of people who understand that this is a disaster. But I think he was afraid of their resigning and saying that he was weak, unmanly, unreliable, that he wasn't really an American or a patriot, etc., and he just didn't want to hear that. So for that reason, to keep himself from being called names, he's willing to condemn any number of Afghans to death and a large number of Americans.
Well, Daniel, I don't give him as much credit as you do. I think that he was put in the presidency to continue to do what George Bush couldn't do. And, you know, we're looking at Iran. We're looking at hostilities increasing for China and Russia under the Obama administration. But I just watched your interview with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! And I think you were trying your hardest to focus on what you call Vietnamistan.
Yes.
And Amy really didn't allow you to go there, I don't think.
I don't think that's true. It was my own fault. If you're referring to the fact that at the very end I was being cut off, I just had failed to get in time, so I pushed ahead with Vietnamistan. No, I must say, I think Amy Goodman is perfectly willing to hear that. She knew I wanted to press that point. That's when she asked me on the program.
You have at least 10 more minutes. Talk about the similarities between Afghanistan and Vietnam right now. And,
well, the crucial one, of course, is that the people we're fighting and killing and their families are essentially motivated in that war by the desire to expel foreigners from their country. That's not the only desire of the Taliban leadership, but it is the motive for most of the people who are doing the actual fighting. And that's what Matthew Ho reports and others. everybody from that area, in fact. Well, that was true in Vietnam. The Viet Cong leadership, the NLF, the Hanoi leadership, had other revolutionary motives, and they had power motives as well. But above all, the recruiting there and the willingness to die in that cause was a willingness of people who had, whose self-image in a nation was that for 2,000 years they had effectively fought off foreign invasion. That was true in Vietnam. And for the same period, astoundingly, it's true in Afghanistan. Yeah. So one similarity they bear is that if you were going to pick places in the world that you should really not try to occupy as a foreign invader, Afghanistan and Vietnam would be vying for the top of that list. And for it's just amazing to me. Another amazing thing is why the military possibly want to do that war, to fight that war. Granted, they may want wars almost all the time for service reasons and for military-industrial complex reasons, but there's so many places in the world other than Afghanistan. Maybe we could invade Grenada again. That worked pretty well. That's just about the right size for us, actually. Or even Panama. For when he wanted to retreat from Lebanon, and he had to invade somewhere else quickly to show how manly he was, and that he was a fit, in your terms now, a fit manager of the empire, that's the basic job, he had to invade somewhere else. Well, I give Reagan credit for picking Grenada as a place to, for the military to earn a lot of medals, fighting Cuban engineers unarmed, essentially, except for small arms. Instead of Afghanistan. What if he'd gone into Afghanistan? My God, we'd be fighting there still, as we will be for many years. So I think Obama and the military have picked a very bad place to throw our imperial weight around. And it's, I would hope that over time, Americans will wake up from this imperial dream and stop following, justifying our wartime economy by these endless wars in other people's countries. But it may take quite a while because they'll conduct this war mainly, largely from the air. The people will be, yes, we're putting troops in, but those troops will be accompanied by a lot of air power, and that will do most of the killing of civilians and others, most of the recruiting for the Taliban, so the war will keep going for quite a while. And without a draft and without military casualties that are as large as Vietnam, the public, I'm afraid, has gotten socialized into being an imperial public pretty thoroughly by now, and they'll put up with it for quite a while. By the way, I am not one of those, and I don't know where you are on this, but I am not one of those who looks forward to a draft for that reason, because, yes, there will be greater demonstrations if we have a draft, and there will be much larger occupations. I think if we had a draft for all the draft resistance you might get, we would have hundreds of thousands of people in Afghanistan and even in Iraq. And if I may, one final point about Iraq, I don't believe at all that he is going to carry out, Obama, his promise to get all of our combat, all of our troops out of Iraq. He may get out all the troops that he calls combat troops. There will be a lot of renaming going on there of people to be becoming advisors and engineers and logistics people and so forth, and maybe even mercenaries rather than being called combat troops. But he has promised to get all troops except mercenaries, out of Iraq by the end of 2011. I don't think there is any chance of that, any chance. It's not just that I doubt that. I feel as certain as I ever am that we will continue to have bases in there as long as Obama is there, and I would say as long as his successor is in there. And those bases will be manned not entirely by mercenaries, but by American troops. So it's simply a lie for him to be saying, and it's not worse or better than the lies of his predecessors.
Well, absolutely. And in Afghanistan, there's another similarity that to Vietnam is that Nixon didn't start Vietnam. Obama didn't start Vietnam, but both of them, I mean, Afghanistan, but of course under their administrations, they've been escalated. Obama has tripled the troop commitment to Afghanistan. And, of course, drone bombing in Pakistan, which, you know, that's another similarity to Vietnam, because there's been no congressional approval for drone bombing in Pakistan, and the CIA is carrying that program out.
Also, it's one of the most, insane, but there must be some sanity in it from somebody's point of view in the White House. They're doing it because they think it kills some of the people they would like to see dead. It also kills an awful lot of other people. And doing it, in a country which is we're not at war with, but which is supposedly an ally, and at least formally, without any agreement of that country, in direct violation of their sovereignty, we are thus undermining a government in Pakistan which is pretty terrible from all points of view, but could get a lot worse. And we are doing what we can do, to assure that it does become worse from every point of view and becomes essentially an ISI or a Taliban government there with full alliance with Al-Qaeda. But we're doing what we can to achieve that by attacking them in this way. So it's as close to an totally irrational strategy as you can get. As well as murderers.
Why do you think they're doing that?
You know, in this case, they do say, this is the program we have that works. Well, that's if they're looking at some, what they call benefit, in the fact that they're probably hitting some targeted members of the Taliban. In other words, selective assassination of people they want to assassinate. We're not discussing the legality of this here, but from their point of view, which, since they don't consider that for a minute, and most Americans don't, but it's an imitation of the Israeli program of selective assassination in Gaza and the West Bank. And so they feel, okay, as for the Israelis, it works for us. We get some guys who are bad guys from our point of view. However, they're looking not at all at the costs of this or the risks in political terms or human terms. There's no question that they're killing lots of people over there that are civilian innocents in this respect, in this combat, from any point of view, and, again, creating hatred of us in Pakistan. Now, I didn't even mention the fact, of course, that Pakistan is a nuclear country, and that to be destabilizing a country like that and intervening without at all helping the conflict that it has with India, doing anything about that, we're endangering the area, endangering the world. It's a mad policy, and as you say, it's Obama's policy even more than Bush's.
Well, what's significant also, to even throw more fuel on the fire, is that many of those drones that are killing innocent Pakistanis and probably enemies of the Pakistani government more than Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, the drones are being launched from airfields in Pakistan.
Yes, while we're denying, of course, that we have any direct involvement in Pakistan. In other words, the war has enlarged to that degree under Bush, but not only there, aside from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we're talking about a war in Pakistan, effectively, but also in Yemen, and I understand to some degree in Somalia. So the man who took the Nobel Peace Prize is involved not just in two wars at the moment, at least one of which he's escalated. And by the way, the comparison I would make there is not so much with Nixon as with Johnson, who inherited a relatively small war involving what were fairly called advisors by the U.S.
Right.
Into a war with combat troops, 500,000. Obama can't put in 500,000 troops until he has a draft or without a draft, but he can put in the troops that he takes out of Iraq. And I think ultimately he will take not all the 90,000 troops that are now there, but perhaps another 40,000 of those, maybe more, maybe 60,000, and leave 30,000. That gives him 60,000 troops to put in Afghanistan in addition to the 30 or 40 that he's putting now into Afghanistan. So I think we're going to be closer to 200,000 troops in Afghanistan by the end of his term than to 100,000 troops. And by the way, the cost estimates should reflect that, and they don't at all. When they come up with horrifying figures like $1 trillion for the next decade or so in Afghanistan. That's based on the assumption that there's a ceiling of about 100,000 troops, which the president has more or less told the American public. I think they should be figuring on something double that, and that would mean double the costs as well.
Well, one unfortunate aspect of the Obama administration is that for the first time in 6 years, the military is making its recruitment goals mostly because of the economy. So
yeah.
Perhaps they don't even need a draft to get the number of soldiers that
could be, yes, for this number, right. I think they do want, ultimately, this is just a speculation, but I think for the goals that they have, especially in Afghanistan, they want a lot more than 200,000 troops in Afghanistan. And for that, they need a draft. And how could they get it? Well, not tomorrow, not under current conditions. They couldn't. But with another 9/11 or an Israeli attack on Iran, which we get involved in and which leads to general hostilities throughout the Middle East, then I think we'll see. We may very well see a draft. And I can imagine, this is a speculation, that some in the military are in effect holding on in Afghanistan and marking time until they get a draft, in which case they could send hundreds of thousands.
Well, you know, I hope that would lead to, you know, to general unrest in this nation, to finally say, we're not fighting your wars for empire and profit anymore.
I would hope that, but to tell the truth, Cindy, I wouldn't count on that at all, I'm sorry to say. We'll have to change the political climate before that happens. I would say, by the way, it's really important for us to do what we can to oppose and expose and change this policy before another 9/11 or another general war, because if and when that happens, I think we'll see a police state fully implemented. We have all the infrastructure of a police state. It was built and organized under Bush, and to some extent under Clinton, by the way, before him. But we've been moving that way for quite a while. I think now we've got the infrastructure in such a way this country could be turned into the German Democratic Republic, the GDR, from one day to the next, just in effect by flipping a switch in terms of detention camps, full-scale surveillance, detention without charges, and torture for that matter. But at that point, I think it's almost a little too late for the resistance to be very effective. I think we need to do what we can before we are all in camps. We need, as we're doing right now, Cindy, it's better for us to be talking now as much as we can and trying to get people mobilized before you and I have to do it from a camp.
Well, you know, absolutely. And you've been in this struggle for decades, and you're still going strong. The last time I saw you, as a matter of fact, I think it was at a benefit for this radio show, and you had been arrested twice that day.
Yeah, well, those are small. Again, as I say, the cost and the risk of taking a stand now is really relatively very small as the world goes. It's a risk that, unfortunately, most of our congresspeople, most of our officials and whatnot, officials are not ready to take, but we've got to change that. And what I'm saying is, before a lot more, you've paid the ultimate price here of having your son, of losing your son in this war. And a lot more people are going to pay that price, and they aren't doing much to avert it at this point, I'm sorry to say. But while we still have the ability to protest and only spend days or weeks in jail, as opposed to Nelson Mandela-type terms,
exactly.
We got to use it.
Well,
use the freedoms we have, because they are perishable.
Well, thank you for your work, Daniel, and for your courage and integrity, and for those words of inspiration. And hopefully we'll be able to talk to you soon again.
Well, thank you, because you and Ann Wright and the others who were with us are give me the inspiration and the energy to keep going. So I thank you for everything you've done in past years.
Well, while I'm here in California, I'm going to go up to Berkeley and see the movie, and I'll let you know. And how can people get a hold of you, or do you have a website?
Yes, ellsberg.net. And I'm going to be working largely, I hope, on the dangers of the nuclear era, which I think, by the way, are not, as of now, going to be reduced at all by President Obama's program, despite his rhetoric of abolishing nuclear weapons. As in other areas, what Obama says is just totally uncoupled from what he does. I pay very little attention to what he says by this time. But nevertheless, I do think that there's more promise of moving this administration than there would be under a Republican. I don't say it's an enormous difference, but I think it is enough of a challenge to give us the responsibility to do what we can. And I mention that because on my website there's a number of articles about the nuclear issues.
Well, we're trying, and we're setting up another camp in the end of May called Camp Out Now on the lawn of the Washington Monument. We hope you can stop by.
Okay,
while we have
yeah.
our camp set up there.
Great. Okay. Well, great to hear from you, Cindy. Keep it up.
You too, Daniel. You keep it up, too. That was Daniel Ellsberg on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, my guest, my dear friend, Daniel Ellsberg, and you for listening.
Make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work. Scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest, I don't want you to ride, I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, God damn it, my life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.